Good morning and welcome to A Public Affair here on KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Today, my guest is author Cornelia Maud Spellman. Her latest book is called Missing. It's a memoir steeped in 20th century family history, but it's not the only book she's authored. But before we get into all that, welcome, Cornelia.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you.
Let's start with your most recent book, Missing. In it, you examine the most recent three generations of your family, particularly on your maternal side. What was the motivation to do this?
Really, Shannon, I wanted to understand what happened to my mother. The photo on the cover of the book is of her senior high school photograph, her yearbook. And that lovely, straight-looking, energetic, even sort of courageous, as young people are, like facing life, that face was not the face that I knew. And I didn't really understand how that person in that photograph ended up in the sad way that my mother did. My mother smoked herself to death, really, at only 63. And she spent 10 years of serious illness before that. So what I mostly saw of her was illness and disability. And I wanted to figure out all that I could about what happened that she ended up as she did.
As you mentioned, your mother did have a smoking addiction, which ultimately took her life. Do you know how it started?
Well, you know, she was born in 1911. So in the 1920s, probably, was when she started smoking. I mean, that was the roaring 20s. And she had the bobbed hair and, everything that went along with it. It was popular. People didn't realize yet how deadly it was. But she was told how deadly it was. And she was able to stop just for a month with some support. But now they know that nicotine addiction actually is as strong as cocaine and heroin, which is a frightening thought. But it wasn't just the nicotine addiction. It was other troubles that mother had, and kind of that her life sort of fizzled out, as Bill Maxwell tells me in the book, because he had known her when she was young. He said she was more vivid than other girls, the way certain tropical birds are vivid. And what happened? Why did she make the choices that she made to have five children and no literary life? And then also at the end of her life, my father, who she really loved very much, betrayed her. And when she was very ill, he kind of plopped her in a nursing home and he went chasing off after her rich friend. And we all thought that she didn't understand what was going on. And I was young enough that I didn't entirely understand what was going on. I loved my father. I couldn't really accept the fact that he lacked as much character as he did. And then there's also the story of my oldest brother, which was a big part of this and a very sad part of it. He went missing. He disappeared when I was quite young. He was 11 years older than I was. He left a wife and baby, and he didn't come back, and nobody knew where he was for many years. And at the end of mother's life, when she was so ill, he had reappeared with a different wife. My parents were seeing him again. And then my father, then he got arrested for embezzling money, my father told me, that is this oldest brother. And my father invited him to live with them while he worked and paid the money back. And again, in retrospect, only when I was writing this book many years later did I think, what was my father thinking that he invited this person who apparently didn't have a conscience into the house? Well, he wanted him to take care of mother so that he could run off after her rich friend. And
well, let me go ahead and stop you there, because you're telling quite a bit about the book, and I have some questions that I want to back up into. You mentioned the New Yorker editor William Maxwell, Bill Maxwell, as being a big influence on you. He knew both of your parents in college, and you gave the sense in the book that he was the successful one of your parents' peer group, whereas their aspirations were stunted by early parenthood. Back up to the beginning and talk about what your relationship was with Bill Maxwell and how this ended up in you telling the story of your family.
Well, I had heard his name as I was growing up because my parents loved reading. They loved writing. They, I think, both wished that they had had literary lives. And they subscribed to the New Yorker magazine. And I used to lie on my stomach as a little girl looking through the New Yorker magazines in a room next to their bedroom. And it struck me as being a very glamorous, amazing place, New York and the New Yorker magazine. So I sensed, without them actually ever having said it, that Bill Maxwell had entered this exciting, wonderful life that they had wanted for themselves. But they chose, I guess you can say they chose, to have five children. And my father was never very good at making a living. And so, you know, they had a lot of difficulties. I think they, anyway, Bill was, to me, when I had the chance to meet him much later in life, because my husband had a connection with him, and I said, tell him that you're married to Nordy and Elizabeth Spellman's daughter. And he invited us to tea in New York in response to that. And I just really loved him right away. He's a very gentle, very sweet, and very interesting man. And he was a kind of good father to me. I think he was to many people. And I think he was very pleased to see me because he could see my parents' faces in mine, and he had liked them very much. So he gave me the gift of telling me what they were like when they were young and happy and healthy.
You mentioned in the book towards the beginning that, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but it was something along the lines of how some of just the ordinary stories are the ones that can be the most engrossing. And I'm wondering, since I see that you previously worked as a therapist, if sitting with and kind of picking at your family history helped you to help others navigate their own issues.
Oh, I think so, for sure. My work as a professional mental health person, I'm not sure I could have written the book if I hadn't had that experience and knowledge, because it did help me understand the dynamics in my family. And was I able to help other people? I certainly hope so, while I was doing it. And my children's books actually were related to that, because I noticed how many people had difficulty understanding what they were feeling. If you would ask them sometimes, how do you feel about that? They didn't know how to answer. And I think it's because so many people, and of course, actually my mother was among them, were not helped. Many, many of us were not helped to understand our emotions, to understand not only how to express them, but how to manage them. Mostly we were told, don't be this or don't be that, right? Don't be angry, don't be sad. And my mother was kind of the supreme example of that, because I think when her father died, which was another important part of the story, when she was only 7, I think that a part of her froze. It froze and it never unfroze. And she was emotionally distant with me and with everybody in a way. She was always kind of acting a part. Another family member said if she had written the book, she would have called it Charades.
My guest today is Cornelia Maud Spellman. We're discussing her book, Missing. How did other members of your family, I mean, you're one of five siblings. I mean, of course, the brother that you referenced who went missing, and I assume that the missing title was in reference to him. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It referred to him, but more it referred to everything that was missing. Mm. What was missing in my mother's life, which was her father, because he was a loving, presence, and he had died when she was a child, and her mother was unable to help her grieve or feel the feelings associated with such a terrible loss. And then what I was missing, because of what my mother was missing and what my father was only capable of. And then my brother literally went missing. So there are multiple meanings to that title.
So going back to my train of thought, how did your siblings or your other family members react to this public airing of family history?
I think my answer would always be they would have to speak for themselves, because I spoke for myself. And so I try not to involve them in any way in my story of my experience.
Well, that's a very diplomatic answer. I think several people could probably see how a deep telling of a family history might be airing a bit more than they would feel comfortable being associated with, because you do name names. You name names and dates, and while it's, I think, the kind of family history that a lot of people can relate to, some people are very closely guarded about what they put out there.
Well, what I learned as a therapist and through my professional education was how important it is for us, and for me in particular in this case, to understand the truth and to be able to speak the truth. In the case of my book, both of my parents were dead. No other names are mentioned. A pseudonym is given for one character. Bill Maxwell gave me his permission. So there wasn't really a question of permission. It was more what you're talking about. I understand well the idea that, oh no, we mustn't talk about that. But the things that we mustn't talk generally are the most important. And I'm not saying there shouldn't be limits. I don't like to read myself books that are trying to get back at people, or, you know, tell the most horrible things you've ever heard in your life. Just what does that add? I don't think that adds to the world. What I was trying to do was show how the pain in a family from another generation, how it works its way through and how it can work its way through. I do think that my children's books were partly a product, unconsciously, of my mother's childhood and my own. I wrote those books so other children wouldn't have to be alone with their feelings. And it's quite remarkable, Shannon, the things that even little children have said to me. It's just so lovely. I had one little child who took one of the books to bed with her because it was so thrilling that she could read with these nice little animal illustrations that animal felt the way she did. Other people feel the way she does. There's a word for it. There's a word for our feelings. It's just a huge relief. So I'm all for sharing secrets if they're shared appropriately and you're not hurting people. I think it's healthy.
The children's books you refer to, you have a series called The Way I Feel. And you say that you know there are different titles as to The Way I Feel. Was this something you had to learn as an adult to retrospectively go back? And did parenthood itself kind of flip a switch for you to understanding the importance of negotiating those feelings and naming them before they get built up inside?
Well, certainly parenting. I'm the parent of two and now the grandmother of four. Certainly parenting taught me a ton, like it does to each of us. But more, I think it was my professional education and my experience, my realizing as I spoke with adults that they had so much trouble still with their feelings, and thinking we have to start earlier. We have to educate children about their feelings. And now that's pretty commonplace. But when my first book came out in that series, which was When I Feel Angry, and which is still the bestseller of that series, this was not so, what they now call social emotional learning was not happening. I'm glad it is now, because it is such an important part of kids' education. So I think that if we don't know what we're feeling and we don't know how to manage it, it's like driving a car without any direction. We really need to know. Our emotions tell us things that are important. But the part that people used to leave off was they would just say, don't feel that. And a lot of people tell themselves, I'm not going to feel that. Jealousy is a good example. And I learned a lot as I was writing the books, because I had to translate basically somewhat complicated concepts into very, you know, simple language. And when I feel jealous, everybody feels jealous, but we really don't like to admit it. And yet it's so helpful. I point out, even animals feel jealous. We all know that, right? If your dog thinks you're paying too much attention to somebody else, you know, the dog's going to let you know.
When I feel angry come out?
I think it was 2000.
So it's been more than 20 years.
And another book that I've done, Your Body Belongs to You, which is another of the bestsellers, of course, was earlier than that. And those two books have sold, the books have sold widely and even in other countries. And I think that's so thrilling and empowering to think of children who are reading them in China or in cultures that are very different from ours, and who are learning what we all need to know.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Cornelia Maud Spellman. She's an author of the latest book, Missing, and prior to that, a series of children's books called When I Feel Angry. She is a professional therapist as well. So I'm wondering, given your professional history as a therapist, as a children's book author, and your own personal history as the child of parents who maybe didn't really understand everything that they were feeling or didn't manage it in ways that were necessarily healthy, right, what age, in your opinion, is the best for really grasping what emotions are with the aim of being able to manage them?
Oh, the younger, the better. Toddlers, little kids. I mean, my books are aimed at very young kids. However, teenagers read them because they're sort of like emotions 101. And kids with autism have found them very useful because they're so clear. This is what I'm feeling. These are the situations that I'm feeling it in. This is what it feels like in my body. And this is what I do. This is what I can do when I feel that. That's such an important part of the message. So the earlier, the better. And give me an example. My little granddaughter was only 2 when her baby brother was born. And she was very jealous, naturally, as you know, who wouldn't be? And when I finally said, when she was angry at him, when I finally said, Poppy, you're feeling angry. That's called angry. And she went, angry? She was just thrilled that there was a word for it. And jealous. We had read that one too. And jealous? Oh, I want to be the most precious person to my mother. And now here's this other person, you know, and don't we all feel that about all sorts of things? We do want to be the most precious person. Anyway, there's something all of us need to learn. And I reread my own book sometimes because I too, even though I've done this, catch myself thinking, I wish I didn't feel that way, or, oh, I shouldn't feel that way. Maybe I'm not such a nice person if I feel that way. And I have to remind myself, feelings are just feelings. I don't have to act on them. That's one of the biggest messages. I can feel anything I want. It doesn't mean I have to say it. It doesn't mean I have to act on it. And so often I won't. But I wish that my mother, yes, knew what she felt. I wish that she had been able to be closer to people, to me, than she was. And I wish that my father had not done what he did. But that's life. And as Bill Maxwell said, going back to that original quote that you were thinking of, it's not an extraordinary life that you look for. It's in an ordinary life, in a novel. It doesn't have to be an exceptional life. It's the ability to look at what actually happened and to convey it to others, to connect. I think really that's the goal of everything that I've written, is to connect to others and to feel connected and to see how we're all related in our feelings and how much difference it makes when there's someone who will listen to you. I wished so much that I could bring my mother back to life and say, tell me, mother, what it was like for you when your father died. I'll listen to you. I'll sit here and listen to you, because she never really had anyone to listen. And I guess she never thought that she should feel certain ways. That I know, because she felt guilty about any negative feeling she had. And she became sort of hyper religious. And in her case, religion only made her feel more guilty.
What advice do you have, both as in your own experience, as an author, as a parent, as a grandparent, and as a therapist, to people for best practices of managing their feelings? And you can tailor this to age groups as well. How to help your kids manage feelings, how to help maybe your elders come out of their shells. Just give us some practical tips.
I think for parents, reading books with their children and talking about the feelings in them can be really helpful, because books give you that safe space. You know, the child isn't talking about his feelings necessarily, and the parent's not necessarily talking about theirs, but they're talking about the little animal character or the characters in the book that they're reading. So reading and noticing, well, oh, look, she looks sad in that picture, or how do you think she felt about that? Just honoring, giving respect to feelings, so that when a child gets really angry, you can say, I can see that you're really angry, but you know, you can't throw things, but I'll listen to you talk to me about your anger. With older people, our elders, like people from another generation, I'm not sure how we can help them if they've, you know, it depends on how strong that wall is that they've built up against feeling. I think there's been a whole movement in this country, and I guess in the world, judging by the translations of my own books, there's been a real change in our attitudes towards emotions. In the old days, perhaps people couldn't afford to have them. You know, they had to work, they had to farm, they had to get the food on the table. They didn't have the luxury, perhaps, of feeling. Maybe that's part of what happened in my mother's time. Or maybe it's the English, the British background of at least some of our American people who were taught, just don't feel that. It's not nice. You're not a good person if you feel that. But it's like saying you're not a good person if you have blonde hair or brown hair or brown eyes. I mean, it's the way we are. We were made this way to have feelings. And the trick is knowing what they are and then knowing how to manage them. And the best way I know to manage them is to talk to somebody trustworthy about them. I don't mean a therapist, a best friend, to talk it out with somebody who's willing to listen to you. And that always solves just about everything, in my experience.
And towards the end of the book, you donate a lot of the personal effects of your mother, her diary, some photos, many of just the family heirlooms and treasures, to especially written material and photographic material, to the Schlesinger,
yeah, it's a tongue twister.
Right.
You did it.
Library at Radcliffe Institute, Harvard University. Tell me about where your family history is now housed, why you decided to give it away instead of just, I don't know, keeping it in a shoebox in a closet.
Well, the shoebox in the closet, you know, just deteriorates, and then the next somebody moves in and throws it out. So when I learned about the Schlesinger, I was just delighted, and I wrote them and said, I have these diaries of my mother's and these family papers and a lot of beautiful photographs, and my own diaries, which I have been writing for 35 years, no, 40 years. And they wanted them because they collect, back to the ordinary lives theme, they collect the diaries and papers of ordinary American women. They also have better known women, like they have Julia Child's papers and even Amelia Earhart's papers, but they wanted them. So I was just completely thrilled. And I think at the end of the book, I fly there with the most precious of mother's papers and give them to the library and turn at the door and feel both thrilled and very sad, because it's as though I'm really leaving her there. I'm leaving that girl who was so lovely looking and courageous looking and looking forward to life. And, you know, she's there for anybody to go and see in perpetuity, or at least as long as the planet lasts.
We are coming up on time. I wanted to ask if there's anything that you wanted to add that I didn't ask you.
I think I'd like to add, for people who are listening who might be interested in writing a memoir themselves, that I found it so helpful to look at the heirlooms and mementos. I don't mean things of value, but I had a nameplate that belonged to my grandfather, and it had sat on his desk. He was a banker in Iowa back in the day. And my mother kept it all those years. And it was a kind of clue for me. Why did she keep that? I couldn't ask her because she died and I didn't think of it then. So I used it as a kind of door to the past. And I traveled to Iowa and I found the old newspaper articles about his death. And the bank, unfortunately, was torn down. But I found the whole history that way. There's a lot of each of our histories that's available if we want to look for it.
My guest today has been Cornelia Maud Spellman, author of the book Missing, and as well as the children's book series When I Feel Angry. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Shannon. It's been a pleasure.
You are listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. This has been A Public Affair, and I've been your host, Shannon Young. See you next time.